Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm playing an interview I did with Joe Morello. Joe is first and foremost a writer. Having started writing in the third grade at 8 years old, she has been writing everything she possibly could ever since. And that hasn't been easy because she has had to do so many other things and had to overcome so many obstacles. Still, she is diligent, she is driven, she is serious. And she currently is having a flurry of success with some of her plays. And one of them is about to be read at the Players Theater on August 17th. Listen to this interesting woman tell you an interesting story. Hang on, here comes the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from
so that you can live the life you were really meant to live. I say every week, if you've been listening, that as a psychotherapist who's been in practice for over 30 years, it is my observation that most people are not who they really are and are not living the life they were meant to live. Most people are stuck living what I call a cover story and in denial for important, significant aspects of themselves. And so much of the work that I do is about helping people discover, realize that the adjectives that they use about themselves, the way they think about themselves, the things they say to themselves about themselves is really not true. It's what they were trained, programmed, forced, maybe, to believe about themselves, and then they keep that idea alive by continuing the internal dialogue that confirms, yes, I'm not so smart, yes, I'm not so brave, yes, I'm not so assertive, and yes, I'm not so pretty, whatever it is. When quite often, they are all those things, smart, brave, assertive, pretty, and much, much more. So my practice is about helping people first to realize that they're telling themselves and the world a lie about themselves, and second, to begin to see if they can figure out what the truth really is underneath the dogma that they've had to accept. And the Lynn Show is about making this point that perhaps you, as one of the many of us, are also in denial for some important aspect of yourself. Perhaps you would be a sillier, funnier person. Perhaps you would be a more serious person. Perhaps there is a skill that you yearned to learn but didn't think you could be good at, or were told, as the person I interviewed today, that it's not appropriate. You will hear Joe Morello, who is my interview today, talking about the messages she heard in her parochial school, that is both elementary and middle school and high school and college, about what it meant to be a woman, about what a woman had to be, about what other people couldn't do in the presence of a woman, and how she had to confront that over and over again to become the person she really is, not to be the person they told her a woman had to be. So perhaps you also experienced that, not only as a woman, but as a man. Were you told that big boys don't cry, that it's a shame for them to express certain emotions? Were you told that men had to support the family, and if they didn't, there was something wrong with them? Which is why we had in the 30s, so many men whose livelihood had dried up jumping out of windows, and why, 50, 70, 100 years, well, not 100, I'm sorry, I'm so bad at math, but whenever it was that we had the crash in the, just now, in the 2000s, we have so much depression in men whose careers dried up, whose houses are upside down, who can't support their family because they think that that is who they must be in order to be accepted, valued, loved. So is there something you think you could not possibly be and hold on to your self-esteem? Is there something you suspect you are but are hiding even from yourself because you're afraid that it will mean something about you and cost you the affection, the concern, the attention, the love of others, or even yourself? So the Lynn Show is all about looking at this, looking to see who's really there, and being able to appreciate, value, honor that person. You can learn more about this, about the book that I wrote called When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It. You can find previous shows and an article on psychotherapy on the go in case you're interested in going into therapy with someone who does all her work on the telephone, like me. You can get in touch with me by clicking on the email link. You can get me to speak to your group or organization, or any number of other things, including listening to the interviews that I have done, all of them. They're all up on my website, thelynnshow.com, thelynnshow, thelynnshow.com. You might notice that I'm speaking very quickly today. That's because my interview with Joe Morello is long, and I didn't want to cut any of it. So I interview people who make their living or their life with an art, and I do that because when you listen to them, you can hear what it sounds like to be who you really are, and to live the life you were really meant to live. And as Joe says at the very end of the interview, making a life with writing is not easy. But she just kept at it. Over and over and over again, she surmounted the obstacle and just kept going. It's a very inspiring story. And I'm not going to say any more because Joe says it better. So here now, Joe Morello. So I'm here with Joe Morello in my kitchen, and I'm explaining to Joe that I interview people who make their living or their life with an art, And I know that the art to which you are giving large chunks of your life is the art of playwriting and theater. Is that accurate?
That's right.
Okay, good. I only ask one question, and that is, how did that start? When was the very first moment that it occurred to you that you might like to write, that you were interested in plays, that stories, whatever? Do you know?
I know, and it's a long story.
That's fine.
It's a funny story, mm-hmm. but I'll give you two antecedent stories. Mm-hmm. When I was in high school, I wanted to act. And
well, wait a second. I think we can go back even a little further than that. Did this interest in acting sort of blossom in high school?
It didn't blossom.
Well, where did you get the idea you wanted to act?
I just did.
Did you see a movie or a play?
No.
So how did you know about actors? Do you know? Do you remember?
They were doing a senior play. And I wanted to be in it.
I got it. Okay.
And I got appendicitis and was out.
Oh.
And so they gave me understudy to a very minor part. I opted not to do it because I had missed too much class, had no time for rehearsal. I guess that was junior year. And so for senior year, I wrote a play for a senior day, whatever it was, and directed it on the stage. And it was great fun.
Okay, this comes out of the clear blue sky. Oh, they do a play. Maybe I would like to be in it. Oh, no, never mind. I'll write and direct. You have no previous?
No.
Nothing?
Well, I guess I was writing because I went to a parochial school, grades 1 through 8. And our local newspaper published a school play every school page every Friday. And they picked me to be the school reporter. But I was only in third grade. I was only 8. And I didn't think it was that unusual.
At the time.
But every Friday afternoon, before the school was due to end, I took my little notebook and went up and down the corridor and knocked on each classroom door and walked in with my pen and said, "Sister, can you tell me what happened this week?" And so I began being published regularly at age 8.
Yeah. You know what's so interesting to me about this is that I think there would be more kids doing this, more kids spontaneously writing, singing, acting, drawing, whatever, if we really allowed that before the questions of whether I can do this, I can't do this, I'm good at it, I'm bad at it, whatever, enter, kids are spontaneously able to access skills like this. So, but most kids don't. So it was unusual.
Well, then in my senior year of high school, this was, bear in mind, a parochial school, and I was at the head of my class, but wasn't permitted to be the valedictorian because there was a male who was several points behind me. He became the valedictorian, I was the salutatorian. And so I was in this environment where women had expectations, and they had decided, they being the nuns, that I should either go into the convent or be a teacher or the other woman's profession, become a nurse.
Wow.
Because I had already refused to take typing and be a secretary. And so...
So there was a little bit of rebel in here.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Always.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted to be a writer, and I thought, no, they're going to... That's what they want. They want me to teach English. I had a nun that year who was kind of a holy terror in the convent. And at the start of the senior year, she asked us all to do a free association list. She gave out words and we wrote things and she collected the lists and looked at my list and said, "You have the ability to be a writer."
Oh, wow.
And I thought, wow, that's news to me. And I still didn't do it. I was going to be a doctor. I had a senatorial scholarship to Penn that the church talked me out of because they said I'd lose my faith.
Oh, dear.
And so I went to Villanova, which at that point was a men's college. But they were taking women. They had a brand new program, collegiate nursing program. And they took women who weren't taking courses that weren't offered in any other Catholic college in the area. And there were some 42 colleges. So it was nursing or engineering. There was one engineer, and I went into nursing, The first year they threw us in with the pre-meds, and that was fine. Second year we had floor duty, and I went on floor duty about one day and decided I went out. This isn't for me. And so I went to the administration and said that I wanted to change and become an English major, and I wasn't permitted to. They said, I said, why not? Well, it's a men's college, and if we put a woman in, the professors may not feel free to discuss works of literature with a woman in the class.
Oy, oy.
I said, but I'm taking anatomy and physiology with the men. So that didn't cut any ice. And then
or make any sense.
No. And then I could have changed. Oh, and also they allowed professors' daughters in the classes. And I raised that argument and it didn't work. I could have changed colleges, but I would have had to take another year because my first year was all labs and sciences, and I didn't want to do that. So I asked for a minor in English, and they don't give minors, and so I went to summer school each year until I came out with an unofficial minor in English.
My God.
So I got married during senior year.
Well, what's so interesting about you, this story so far, is that you are both living up to the conventional ideal and not at exactly the same time. You're being a good girl and a bad girl at the same time.
Well, the other thing was that I wanted to get married, and Villanova accepted women who had an RN degree already to come in for a bachelor's. But if we went in as an undergraduates, we weren't allowed to marry. They called us the basics. At the same time, they were allowing men to marry. And so I had a three-year fight going with the administration on that one. And my question there was, since you allow the graduate nurses to marry, why not us? And they said, well, suppose you get pregnant, a patient might feel awkward asking you to do things for them.
Wow.
And so I won that fight. I got married along with two of the other students during our senior year. I worked at nursing briefly. I had my children and I began freelancing. So I wrote for freelance articles for the Philadelphia Bulletin and for magazines here and there. And as soon as my kids started school, I went back to Temple and took a master's in communications and have been writing ever since. My first husband was a design engineer, was a genius on computer memories and things like that, and NCR hired him to go out to Cambridge, Ohio to design memories for their, they were just getting into the computer game very late. And so I went out there, and Cambridge was really, and still is, very small and very insular, and the nearest big town was Zanesville. And they were having trouble getting employees to come. The only thing going there was a little community theater in a barn. And so I kind of had a flair for it, and I got release time from work for a little while to go and make that theater run.
Wait. Release time from work as a nurse?
No, I'm sorry. I was an engineering technical writer at NCR.
Oh.
And my husband was my then husband was an engineering designer, a memory designer, and what they call him, a logic design engineer. Not very much release time. It was a summer stock theater, community theater, although they called themselves professionals.
So you went in sort of as an administrative person to put it together? I mean, to...
No. Well, yeah, I guess.
I mean, just, to organize it, to make sure, I don't know.
To hire, right? My ex-husband became the president of the theater association. I was the managing director.
Ah, right.
And so I was doing the day-to-day operations. Mm-hmm. I didn't get very much release time. I had to be back and get my engineering specs written. But I did that for 3 years and would go and sit at the back of the house, at the top of the risers, and I would watch rehearsal, play, and I got to see what audiences react to. Mm-hmm. I got to see what works. And I got an award. The AAUW gave me an award for Outstanding Woman in the Performing Arts. And then moved back east, went back into writing, which is, at that point I worked for Educational Testing Service as an editor. Then I went to...
So you're writing all the time?
Yeah, always writing.
So it's not, it's currently play, but actually the art to which you seem to have given most of your life is writing itself.
Yes, I was going to mention that when you said in plays.
Yeah.
And then I got a job at the Franklin Institute Research Laboratory in Philadelphia, which was the for-profit arm of the Franklin Institute, a famous science museum. The Franklin Institute Research Laboratory was the oldest in the country. I think it was formed in 1831, and I became the first female manager.
Wow.
In the 1980s. But I was then public relations, public information manager. I was responsible for writing their engineering documents, their publicity, their brochures. I was also attending graduate school at Temple University. And as soon as my children started school, I went to Temple and started the graduate program in communications. It was Temple School of Communications and Theater.
Mm.
But I was on the communication side. There was one journalistic position in the whole broadcasting side. I was in radio, TV, film, and this was as assistant editor to the Journal of Broadcasting, a scholarly journal, and I got that position. So I was a graduate assistant doing journalism work in the Department of Radio, TV, Film. And in fact, I had never taken a journalism course and had to. It was a prereq, and I wound up as a volunteer lecturer for one of the first classes, telling the class how to get published. So I did that, and then I almost finished my master's, except for the experiment, which was going to be on the physiological effects of televised violence.
Wow.
And at that point, I was working at Educational Testing Service as an editor. Had a problem getting time off to do the experiment to finish the degree, and I resigned. Finished the degree, wrote my thesis, and got the job at the Franklin Institute at that point.
Wow. I'm just curious, did you find that there's an impact on what from watching violence on TV?
Well, bear in mind that I had no funding.
That's
this was
right.
Very, very primitive. I had a good psychologist and some of the known researchers in the effects, and we administered tests, pre-test and post-test, and we found that there were some people that we called hot reactors, the ones in the psychological test who got most upset most quickly. Those did show a physiologic response to televised violence.
Wow.
Others did not.
Really?
So much. We had created stimuli.
Mm-hmm.
We were showing segments of a televised segment that we pretested and declared was violent, and one that was neutral, and one, I've forgotten what the placebo was. And the main response we got from the non-reactors was boredom.
Wow, how interesting.
In many cases. But I never even wrote the abstract. I was so burned out and so tired, and they said, write the abstract, and you only need to do 100 words. And at that point, I had two children. I was working full-time. I was just finishing my abstract, and it just was one thing too many.
Yeah, well, I understand that.
So,
well, okay, so then...
Oh, so then I worked at the Franklin Institute Research Laboratory, and it was all scientific. And I'm very comfortable there. I have a bachelor's in nursing. I had all the science courses as an undergrad. And I also did, as I mentioned, all the public relations. Mm-hmm. I did special events. They were government contractors, so I did events for the government on discoveries that would neutralize PCBs and things like that. They were bought by Arvin after I'd been there 7 years, and they were moved to Schenectady. And so I wasn't needed. At the time, my two daughters had finished college. One had skipped a grade. They finished the same year. I was also getting a divorce. So, and my parents had moved to Sarasota a couple of years earlier. So at this point, I said to somebody, I am a wife with no husband, a mother with no children, a career woman without a job, and I don't even know what my name is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And so some friends were in Sarasota, and they were going to do a startup on a company and asked me if I would come down and do it. And I didn't feel that it was going to work. And I said to my mom and dad, why don't I come stay in your guest room, and we'll see what happens. And that's what I did. In the interim, my house sold. And the realtor called and said, what do we do with your furniture? That's why I'm in Sarasota. I said, well, I guess ship it down here and I'll put it in storage. And so that company didn't work, the startup. I interviewed with 3 or 4 PR firms here, and none of them would hire me. And they're all gone, by the way. And I started with the Blake Hospital account, as a matter of fact, doing PR for them for a couple of years. A couple of years later, because I came down here in 85, 86, in 1988, Jack Gilhooly, playwright, was brought here by Florida Studio Theater. They were doing a reading of one of his plays, and we met. And that's another long story and another long conversation, but ultimately we were dating and we were getting serious, and one day he handed me one of his scripts, and this is a scene from a play we later wrote called The Split that Manatee Players produced, but the script was pretty beat up.
Beat up?
Beat up, typed with a light ribbon, had Snowpake on it, lots
of
erasures. Yeah, this was before scanners were very good, and really before many people were on computers. But I had been on them since before there were computers, when mm-hmm. I was working for NCR. And the big new development then was called a Wang machine, which mm-hmm. is word processor. So one day, I set the kitchen timer, and I said to Jack, I will never be your typist, but I want to see how long it would take to transfer one of these to computer. So I set it for an hour, and after 45 minutes, I said, heck, I could do this. Not realizing how arrogant that was.
You meant you could write a play.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Talking to a man who had been a department chair of a theater department in a college, who had been done by Joseph Papp, who had been produced all over the world. And I blithely said, oh, I could do this. And he said, well, do it. And he knew that I had always been a writer, mm-hmm. and he knew about my summer stock experience, and he decided I could combine the two. And so I said, how do I do it? What do I do? And he gave me Dramatist Source Book, and being the marketer that I am, I immediately, first of all, I didn't want to compete with him. And he wasn't writing for young audiences, so I decided that's where I would go. Then as a marketer, I looked to read specs, and it said, they were saying things like cast size of no more than 6, must fit within a class period. I said, oh, okay.
Yeah, right. They told you how to
sure.
do it.
Okay. Right. So he was writing, and he writes in longhand, and he would consider 4 pages a day to be really good, and I had no idea of the process.
Right.
And so he said to me, how many pages did you write today? And I said, 35. I felt very blithe and happy, but right. you know, I it was a close deadline, so I cleaned it up a little bit, and I said, okay, I'm done, and it's the deadline, what do I do with it? And he said, I'll show you, and he got a big brown envelope, and he addressed it, and he stuck it in, and I said, that's it? No letter, nothing? He said, no. He stuck out his tongue, and he looked at half the envelope, and he said, wait just a minute. And he went and pulled 2 of his scripts off the shelf.
And stuck them in.
And stuck them in the envelope.
Uh-huh.
And I said, you're going head to head against me, my first time out. And he said, get used to it.
Wow.
And I won the contest. And that's how I became a playwright.
Unbelievable. And when you won, did you say to him, get used to it?
Many times since.
Yes, right. Wow.
And so I went, I didn't even know what a workshop was. Choate Rosemary Hall brought me up to workshop the play.
Where?
Choate Rosemary Hall, where Michael Douglas went to school, and Glenn Close and the Kennedys and all of those up in Connecticut. So I workshopped the play, and the next year the Eugene O'Neill Theater Center, 1 year only, held the Young People's Drama Project, and I submitted, and so did Jack, and I won.
Oh, God.
And so I went up and workshopped it there.
Does he feel that he, it's like Frankenstein? That he
sometimes, but he beats me out a lot, too, and he should.
Yeah.
I mean, he's, I bow to his experience and all the rest of it, and we have very different world outlooks. We only ever managed to write one play where we survived, and that's the one I mentioned, The Split, but it's about a husband and wife who are playwrights. So I have of late suggested a collaboration to him, and I think we're going to do it, and I think we're going to survive it because this is different. I had a play, my play about Eugene O'Neill, UGO, The Passions of Eugene Gladstone O'Neill, and it won a contest in 06 and a production at a community theater. And they canceled it because they couldn't cast it. And so...
Why couldn't they cast it?
This past June, the play won a production at a community theater in Virginia. And it's a whole long, sad story. I had brought professional actors and directors into the reading, and they said, we want to do a production in 2 months. Is that all right? And, of course, you'll bring your professional actors. I said, no, I don't think so. So I did the revisions, got all ready, heard nothing, and I called them the first day of rehearsals, and I said, how was the script? And they said, we meant to call you. We canceled. We can't cast it.
What is this with they can't cast it?
It's a very difficult play. And community actors don't have enough time to get in there and learn the roles. Mm. And this one had wanted to hire equity actors, and they found out they didn't have the funds. I said, well, just hire the lead. And they said, well, we don't have a director either. So it's the first theater I mentioned. That director also told me I wasn't allowed to attend rehearsals, which is in violation of Dramatists Guild rules.
And nuts!
And I tried to find out why. Mm-hmm. And it turns out he was very inexperienced, working his way through a divorce, down here to find himself, attending school to become, a social worker. And so I asked him to join me for coffee, and I said, why can't I attend your rehearsals? And he said, I've never done a play by a living playwright before. And so now I've won another contest, and the play's going to have its world premiere production in Kentucky in September. But along the way, there have been some bumps. And I said, what's the problem? We don't do plays by living playwrights. And so I am hearing we can't cast and living playwrights so many times. I think you heard me read my little play, mm-hmm. Talk Back.
Yeah.
And that's about William Shakespeare presenting Romeo and Juliet for the first time, and an audience is commenting on it. So I thought about this, and I said to Jack, listen, we both have written lots of comedies about what happens to playwrights. Why don't we put an evening together of these experiences of short plays and call it Life Upon the Wicked Stage?
Mm-hmm. Lovely.
And so Talk Back will be the first, mm-hmm. and then I'm going to write one called The Dead Playwrights Society, mm-hmm. which will be about 10 minutes, and I'm going to write one called The Casting Couch, mm-hmm. and Jack and I have already written for The Split. We're going to pull a scene from that, and he's got a lot of others where he's written. One of them, he was running the reading series at the Players years ago, and at one point he had a playwright who wanted to submit, who wanted his dog to be the lead. Now, I don't mean just the lead character, but I mean the lead actor. And so Jack has written a play about that called Dog Lovers. And so we have the series, and I think we're going to pull it together. And first we said 70 minutes, no intermission. And then I counted up, and we were over 120 minutes. So as soon as...
So are you going to edit it down, or are you going to make it an evening?
We're going to make it an evening with an intermission. We still have to edit it down. Mm-hmm. He's got one play, full-length play, that I can see we're going to pull two segments from it. And I think it's going to be fun. But right now I have 6 scripts in play of things I've written before that I have to work on, like the talkback. I just converted to a radio play for a contest the other day where it's a finalist. And my O'Neill, I'm doing revisions for the premiere. And my comedy that they're doing at the Players in August, we just cast this.
When does that, well, I want to talk a little bit about
August
that.
August 17th.
Great. Do you want to say something about it?
Oh, sure.
Go ahead.
It's a play called Ma, Moonflowers and Me, a comedy for people old enough to know better.
Aww.
And it's about a man who's in his 60s, whose wife disappeared 40 years ago. He doesn't know why. He tried to find her for a while and gave up. And now he's kind of enjoying keeping that marriage as insurance, so that if any women make moves on him, he says, gee, I'm sorry, I'm already married. He's got a mother, a very lively mother who's 80, who has been thrice married and just recently widowed. And every time she's widowed, she bounces back to him. She's afraid to be alone. And now he's been dating a woman for 10 years, and she's getting tired of waiting, and she begins to give him an ultimatum. And at the same time, he learns that his wife has died. And so the thing is that the girlfriend and his mother are bitter enemies. And he can't marry the girlfriend and bring her into the home as long as his mother's in the house. And so he's trying to get her to move into a retirement home, which she does until she finds out that they're getting married. And so the whole thing is that the elderly Romeo and Juliet are trying to get to the altar before they need to get to a retirement home. And I'm tickled we got a cast. Annie Morrison is going to play the mother. I'm just so thrilled. We have a 17-year-old girl shows up and starts to move things into motion. And we were casting the Players the other night. We had auditions and a young girl showed up that I was just thrilled to see. I've worked with community theater and I've worked with professional, and you never know what you're going to get. And she was showed so much range in 60 seconds.
Wow.
There were 1-minute auditions for a 16 or 17-year-old. And so that's great. And we saw some others who were really wonderful. So I'm excited.
Okay,
about
so let's
that.
Just say this again. It's August 17th at the Players Theater.
Saturday night at 7:30 p.m.
At 7:30 p.m.
And
okay.
It's part of their new play series. There are 5 finalists, and they'll be presented Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday, because the jazz club has a Dick Hyman concert in there on Friday.
Ah.
And I'm glad I can get to go to that, too. Anyway, the judges will then decide, and the winner of these 5 finalists gets a production next year.
And who decides? The judges?
Some judges from the Players.
Do you know who they are?
I don't. And I don't know if it's public knowledge or
right,
not.
Right, right. And maybe you don't need to know.
I probably don't.
No.
I mean, I'd want to get out of contract on somebody. No, I don't.
I know. I'm a little overwhelmed by your how much you've produced. I mean, my God, you must be writing all the time.
Actually, I have a day job.
Yes, I know that.
And I don't get time to write.
Right.
I mentioned that I have 6 scripts in play, but except for Talkback, which I wrote 2 or 3 years ago, nothing is new writing.
Ah.
And all of a sudden there's this interest. The very first plays I wrote that won at Choate, I wrote another one for young audiences that also won at Choate. And I met a director in Washington 2 weeks ago who wants them. She does children's theater. And so I'm updating them too. So I really am working on them. I have clients, and I had been very, very, very busy. I had, I don't know how many builders at one point.
You're doing PR for them.
I do PR. Mm-hmm. I do special events. I do brochures. I do whatever they need. And I've been doing PR down here since 86.
Wow.
I incorporated down here then. When the housing bubble burst, I lost a lot of them, but I have other, I have Coldwell Trust Company in Venice and Sarasota, which is a wonderful client. And I'm so lucky that I don't have to take anybody I don't like and don't believe in.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of my builder clients came back about 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, because the the economy is coming back, right. The building is coming back, right? You'll be.
And at one point, my entire client base was not for profits.
Wow.
Which was a really bad mix. And one of them came back a few months ago. Mm-hmm. So my clients are coming back, and so I'm busy.
They're getting money. Yeah, they're becoming more solvent, so they can afford to hire the help, right?
Yes, and it's nice for me to know that they come back to me.
Yes, right.
Because they could go anywhere.
Yeah, right.
So I do write a lot.
Yeah, you're still writing a lot. You're just not writing plays.
Right, and I'm trying to. Jack said to me yesterday, "When are we going to get on the Wicked stage, the new one?"
Mm-hmm.
I said, "Well, I mean, I'm doing my own bookkeeping too, and so I have to do my taxes and traveling a bit. I will be going to Kentucky for the premiere."
Right. When is that?
September the 13th.
Okay.
It's in Lexington, Kentucky, and it'll be. What was exciting to me that you probably don't know, it was the Kentucky Women Writers Conference and the University of Kentucky sponsor a play contest that they just started 2 years ago because they saw the studies about how few plays by women are produced. And they decided, and if you look at my resume, I have had lots of stage readings, lots of development, lots of prizes, very few productions. And that's true of any playwright, male or female. But they decided that this would be an opportunity to produce a woman playwright. And so Kia Corthran from New York, who's well-known in the inner playwright circles at least, she made the final selection. She was just a guest artist at the Hermitage last year.
Ah!
So that was really nice for me too, to know that.
It's lovely. It's lovely. And it's lovely that your work is being recognized.
Yeah, just finally.
Yeah.
Just finally.
Well, I don't know about finally. I mean, it's...
Well, yeah, I've had...
Yes, I know, right, okay. I only ask one other question, and that's pretty much what we've been talking about, and you really have spent a life writing. I mean, that's...
Well, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
I mean, really, since the third grade.
Yes.
You've been writing, right? And so my question is just... What you would say about what that's like to have dedicated so much of your life to the skill, to the art of writing?
First of all, I would say that it's hard.
Mm.
I don't think people understand that.
Mm-hmm.
And some of it has come very easily to me. But I recall that I had been freelancing back when my children were still at home, when they were babies. But then I moved down here and decided to freelance for magazines, and I was getting rejection. And I was just so discouraged. And I decided I was going to figure out why and fix it.
Right.
I don't know yet why, but somehow I fixed it. And so I wrote, as you said, since age 8, but I didn't become a good writer until computers. Because I'm a bad typist, and it's tedious, and I rewrite so much, so intensively, so that I write? Yes, I write, but mostly I rewrite.
I understand. I wanted to write a book, and I can't type worth anything. So I wrote this all out in longhand.
Oh, my gosh.
And then, so I had like a chapter, right? And then I gave it to a friend to type, and she gave it back to me. And in order to rewrite it, I cut and paste it and cut and paste it. And then I give it back to her, and she retyped it and gave it back to me. And I would never have written the book if I had to keep doing it like that. And so for me, it wasn't until I got a computer that I could actually write a book. Because that was... I
forgot to mention, when I went to Villanova, and it was a men's college, I joined the newspaper. And my sophomore year, I was instantly made copy editor. And I moved on up and became the first female editor there. I was associate editor with a man. Mm-hmm. But I made such wonderful and lasting friends with the staff of the Villanovan. For me, this was
just
a
real
great bonding experience. And we had a reunion last year, and we all went back and caught up, and it was as if we'd never been apart.
You know, it's interesting. You quite often hear that from actors. who say, you know, and when I got in the drama department and I knew I had this this community of like-minded people, it sounds like you're saying pretty much the same thing, that there was a bond around this skill. Or maybe
well,
not.
No, there was. But it wasn't just the skill. I think it must be the kind of personality that was drawn to it. This was before computers, of course. But this was even before cold type. We used to go to the printers every Wednesday night. We put out a weekly that was a pretty good-sized newspaper. And we had to go down after they were done their day's work. And they were setting stories in hot lead, hot type. And so we were working with them and doing the revisions there. Then when I was a graduate assistant at Villanova, I edited one of the professor's books, and at this point we were now on cut and paste with some kind of word processing. And so I've been through the whole series
of
it.
Yes, you have.
But when you talk about type, rewrite type, retype, retype, I have cut and pasted, stapled pages, and the things are hanging. Getting back to Eugene O'Neill, although we never were there. But, well, actually, when I started to write about him, and this again was Jack's inspiration, he told me something about O'Neill that intrigued me. He had said he and his son were estranged, and then they reconciled, and the son committed suicide.
Whoa.
And I thought, wow, what a great two-hander. And this was about 15 years ago, and I started looking into it, and he said, don't go there. If you go into the world of O'Neill, you'll never come back out. And so that two-hander was 14 actors, and Bob Tricolini directed the first reading over at the Players' Lobby, and then it was done at Venice Little Theater, it was then. The Eugene O'Neill Foundation did a reading of it out at O'Neill's property in California in his barn, and they gave me the most wonderful actors, including Cynthia Basham that Edward Albee uses for his plays. And then the Eugene O'Neill Society produced two scenes at their international conference in Provincetown.
Wow.
And these were both in 05. At this point, I'm on the board of the Eugene O'Neill Society, and I also edit their newsletter and write most of it. And so I've become something of an expert on O'Neill. I've done lectures here and there, but when you talk about typing, O'Neill had a disease that they thought was Parkinson's. They found out it was a familial tremor, but for the last 10 years of his life, he could not write at all. Prior to that time, his third wife, Carlotta, did all his typing for him, and she would type, and he'd revise, and she'd type, and he'd revise. As he was losing his ability to write, he wrote in longhand, a very tight little script. He tried a dictation machine and couldn't do it because he rewrites so much.
Yeah.
And which is just what you and I and most other writers today, I think, have run into. But for him, that was the end of his career.
Wow.
So he wrote close to 50 plays in his lifetime. And the last 10 years wrote nothing. Just think what we'd have.
Yes.
If he hadn't been ill.
And what that must have been like for him.
It was horrible.
Yeah.
It was a living death. He had said one time that he is only living when he's writing. And when he could no longer write, he was dead.
Wow. And that's...
A grim note.
Well, I was thinking, you know, I asked you what giving your life to writing would be like.
Yes.
Clearly what giving his life to writing for him was, it was his life. But that's not true for you.
Oh, no.
No, you have a lot of life things going on beside the writing.
Yes, and people have asked me, I guess I've become beyond what they call a woman of a certain age. And I'm getting a little tired of people asking me when I'm going to retire, because what would I do?
People ask you when you're going to retire?
Yes.
Do they really?
I've gotten that about 3 times in the past month or so.
I'm just curious, are those people older or younger than you? Do you know?
One of them just is still under 50.
Wow.
Another one has just retired, a relative, and she's enjoying retirement so much she wants the same for me.
Yes, right.
But when you had your tea here, I mentioned that. And I said, people ask when I'm going to retire, and everyone here yelled out, why?
Exactly.
And they're all of the same feeling, because they're all creative. And I've thought further about it when I said the relative asked me, because she was a vice president, fairly high up in a bank, and very capable and still high energy. And then I said, but you know, if I had to go and clock into a desk at 9 every morning and be there all day every day, I would probably be glad to retire too.
Yeah. I'm thinking that people who give their life to an art are people who are doing what they want to do.
That's right.
So why would they not want to do it anymore?
Well, true. Mm-hmm. And it's a tremendously expensive trade-off, because yeah. She's got a wonderful salary, and she has retirement, she has pension, she has health insurance. We creatives either provide it for ourselves or
don't have it. Right. That's another conversation, but that is about the culture that we live in that doesn't support that.
Of course.
So do you have any plans for things that you want to do in the near future? Or?
Oh, sure.
Do you want to tell?
Well, I did talk about, well, I do want to get these plays mounted. That's the immediate future.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But then I want to, my client load is, for the most part, seasonal, less so now that I don't have all builders. And so my busy season is always November through Easter for clients. But it's becoming year-round, and I'm always struggling to find enough time to do new writing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my plan. What is your plan? Somebody said to me, why don't you do writing full-time? And why don't you quit PR? I said, because PR pays and writing costs.
Right, exactly.
And so my immediate plan, my mid-range plan, and my long-term plan are to find time to do new writing. Next on the books is this play called Life Upon the Wicked Stage. And I did suggest one to Jack about a year ago called Snowbirds that we started on. But that would be all new writing, where Life Upon the Wicked Stage is going to be more a compilation and editing.
Right.
And
easier to get done quickly.
Yeah, and the other thing, besides my day job, my bookkeeping, you know, and my life, we go to a lot of plays because mm-hmm. that's part of the job. Mm-hmm. And we do a lot north of the Skyway as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a 2+ hour round trip. But I've had readings up there, and so has Jack. But new writing can be so much fun.
Yes.
And the thing that really sucks away the time from, at least from playwrights, is marketing it.
Mm-hmm.
Getting it out to theaters and saying, would you look at it?
Yeah.
And so few theaters in the country even do new plays. And if they do, they do one.
Well, you just said, you know, that they don't want to do live authors, so
yeah.
How would they be doing new plays?
Yeah, and the one who said that to me said, because you know why? Because Dramatists Guild won't let us change a single word. And my first thought was, duh! I mean, I work 10, 12 years to find exactly the right word, and they're upset because they can't just change it arbitrarily. So it's an interesting and it's a busy life.
Yes, it is, and that's a good place to stop. Yeah. Thank you very much, Jo.
You're welcome.
Well, there you have it. It is possible to confront the obstacles that life puts in your path and stay centered in who you really are so that you can live the life you were meant to live, as Jo clearly demonstrates by living the life that she is so clearly meant to live, a writer at the age of 8, and still, if she is correct, a woman of a certain age or more, still writing, still looking to steal time to do that thing that's so much fun. And it's fun because it's who she is. And when you're doing what you are meant to do, when you are being yourself, it's fun. It's one of the ways you know whether you're doing it or not. Well, as I said, this was a fairly long interview, and so I am running right towards the end of this show. And I want to reiterate, remind, say yet again that you can find this interview, this show, and all of the shows I have ever done, including and information about me, what I do, how I do it, whether you want to do it with me, on my website, thelynnshow.com. And I want to say, as I have always said, I really hope you got something from this show that you can use, something that you didn't know, something that you knew but had managed to bury, something that triggered something inside of you about who you are, who you might be, who you would have been. Well, something that'll bring you back, because I will be back next week, same time, same station, and as always, I sure hope you will be too.
See, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you see my face and figure. I've both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. That I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage? Let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes, every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have gotten limper, but I won't